Okay, so welcome everyone to our weekly class slash lunch and learn for those who are on Zoom. And once again, please do spread the word that we are back in business for those who would like to attend in person. Even those who have not come before are welcome to come as well. I have some unfortunate news. I just mentioned that unfortunately, Dahlia Kathy Levine passed away last week, as many of you know already. And she was a regular, along with her husband, David, who should live and be well, at our classes, and really a wonderful, perspicacious, upbeat, optimistic woman. And as we found out, I was unaware at the funeral, I forget the exact number, but something like 365 foster children who passed through their home over the years, you know, from basically child delinquents who needed a, you know, some sort of a caring, loving home for a while, you know, certainly. And she wrote books on the subjects of dealing with difficult children and teenagers and so on. I could write a book on that also. But anyway, so her memory should be for blessing. And David is sitting Shiva in Southeast Denver in different places. There's a schedule that H sent out. If you're interested, you can email me and ask me. I could forward you the email. Okay, so that is just the unfortunate news. Now, a couple other announcements. There is a Torah for Tycoons class this Wednesday night at 7:30 p.m. The link is the same as the Zoom link that I send out for this class. It's at 7:30 p.m. And if there are any lawyers, so there are actually CLE credits available for this class, one general and half in ethics. I guess lawyers only have to be half ethical. I don't know. But, you know, someone once pointed out, you know, a list of oxymorons, you know, they said business ethics are one of those oxymoronic phrases. So, the topic is mediation versus litigation. And it's actually in conjunction with, some of you are familiar with the Clean Speech Colorado program that's going on now. And if you're not, you can go to their website, just Google Clean Speech Colorado. And it's, you know, it's going on this month. Hi, Marsha. And so we're doing it in conjunction with that. So litigation versus mediation will be the subject in terms of creating peace versus, you know, which is what a goal of mediation is, that both sides come to a mutual agreement as opposed to litigation where one side is right and one side is wrong. So that will be our conversation in conjunction with that.
What's the difference between arbitration and mediation?
Arbitration is where a third party gives a decision and the other two parties are bound by that decision. Mediation is where a third party works to negotiate between the two sides that they come to a mutually agreeable agreement. Okay. So, I'm Abraham Malamed. Some may know him as Avrami Malamed, son of Rabbi Shlomo and Esther Malamed, who is a lawyer in Los Angeles and has his own law firm, his own mediation firm, I should say. So he will be speaking via Zoom from LA, and yours truly. The last announcement is that this Sunday, the Kollel is having a very exciting event on the West Side, and that is a Hachnosas Sefer Torah celebration, a Torah scroll inauguration. And that will begin with the final, the writing of the final letters of the Torah scroll at about 12:30 p.m. by the Beis Yaakov dorm that's down Zenobia, off of 13th and Zenobia. And then at around 1:15, there will be a procession up the block, a parade of sorts with music and dancing and all sorts of, you know, stuff going on from the Beis Yaakov up to the Kollel. And we're even bringing in a big name singer from the East Coast tri-state area, a fellow by the name of Joey Newcomb. Google him if you want to know more about him. And, you know, in the Orthodox world, he's a pretty well-known singer.
What day is this again?
Sunday, this Sunday. Okay, so 12:30 p.m. will be the final letters written, and then around 1:15 p.m. will be the procession and the parade. Okay, so Ethel, you could even come in from Arizona for that. If you want to buy a letter, reach out to me. I'll find out details if you're interested. Okay, all right. So those are the announcements. Yes, Marcia.
You announced, I'm sorry already. Is it Wednesday night for?
Yes, I just said it. Yes, I did mention it. Yes, I did. Okay, so this week's parasha is Parashas Toldos, and so this week we get into the life of Yitzchak. Last week he got married, and this week we get more into his life. We also meet Yaakov and Esav, and Yaakov's purchase of the rights of the firstborn from Esav, and then subsequently, when Yitzchak wants to give Esav the blessings, so Yaakov is kind of pushed by his mother into getting what's rightfully his. And those who listen to my weekly Parsha recordings, I discussed a couple weeks ago, the idea that this is the second time we find in the Torah where the matriarch is stepping in to kind of overrule the patriarch. We have it with Sarah and Avram, where Sarah tells Avram Yishmael has to be pushed out of the picture because he's posing a danger to the future of the Jewish people. And again, this week, Rivka recognizes that Esav is also a danger and a problem, whereas Yitzchak does not appreciate the full scope of Esav's wickedness and of his corruption, and Rivka does. And so Rivka steps in. In this case, she doesn't tell Yitzchak straight up. She rather tells Yaakov that he has to engage in some, sneaky, some deceptive tactics to get what is rightfully his in this week's parasha. And the parasha concludes with Esav being rather upset with Yaakov for stealing his blessings. And Esav says he's going to kill Yaakov. And Yitzchak and Rivka tell Yaakov he better get out of town before Esav kills him till things calm down. And so he's going to go back to Haran, where his mother comes from. And that will be next week's parasha, where he's going to find a wife and have lots of adventures and a lot of work.
Could you explain what rightfully his means?
Yeah, he bought it fair and square.
He didn't buy the blessing, though.
He bought the rights of the firstborn, and included in the rights of the firstborn is the rights to the blessing of the firstborn.
In that case, why didn't he just go to his father and say, hey, it's mine now?
So the simplest answer would be that they didn't document the sale, and so he had no way to prove it. And the rule is that, if we say in Hebrew, Hamoytze Mechaver El Varaya, if you want to extract something from someone else, you've got to prove that you purchased it or that you acquired it. And so as long as Yaakov can't prove it, then possession, began with Esav, remained with Esav. And it's unlikely that Esav is going to, just say, oh, yeah, that's right. Yaakov purchased it for me, and therefore I give him the blessings. And proof in the pudding is because when Yaakov does take what's his, Esav is not a happy camper. Although Esav unwittingly admits to the fact that he sold it during his tirade at the end of the parsha, when he is bemoaning the fact that Yaakov tricked him. So Esav says, he tricked me twice. He got me to sell him the firstborn rights, and now he took the blessings. And at that point, Yitzchak says, oh, is that so? Well, then he says, Gam Baruch Yiyah. May he also be blessed. In other words, Yitzchak realizes at that point, what really went on. And so Yitzchak himself gives his blessing to the blessing. And so that's kind of what happens over there. Now, there is a lot of discussion in halacha exactly how one sells firstborn rights. I can sell you a car. I can sell you a house. I can sell you a watch. Just like to buy one. But how do you sell something as intangible as firstborn rights? So there's a lot of discussion about that, and that's not my conversation right now, but there is talk about how that could work. Okay, so the question is a fair question, but the halachic authorities do figure it out and decipher. In general, when you're selling rights to something, it's an intangible that you're selling generally. So how do you transfer ownership of something that's not really tangible? There's a lot of discussion about that. Okay. All right, futures, options, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of discussion in the Talmud, a lot of discussion in the Talmud about how that stuff works.
So one question, did Esav get the firstborn rights the second he was born firstborn?
Yes, yes, okay. Esav got the firstborn rights by dint of being born the firstborn. Okay. Yes, so in other words, he was the firstborn. But those rights, were sold to Yaakov. Okay, so what to focus on today, I think, is worthwhile to indeed discuss what Yitzchak thought, what Rivka thought, why Yitzchak was wrong, how Yitzchak can make a mistake like that. He's a prophet. He's a very great person. How could he make a mistake like that? And what Rivka saw that Yitzchak didn't, and why, therefore, it was imperative for Yaakov to get those blessings. Okay? generally in the world today, we don't make like such a huge deal about blessings. Oh, you gave a blessing? Sure, I'll give you a blessing also. I got lots of blessings to give out. You know, today, unfortunately, in a very commercialized, superficial world, people think that great rabbis have nothing better to do with their lives than just sit around blessing everyone all day. So therefore, you know, everyone lines up by their doors to get blessings. And, you know, they just now become like a photo op. I have to get a picture of me getting a blessing from the rabbi and hang it on my wall because the rabbi has nothing better to do with himself than take pictures of me and autograph my, you know, and so on. And they're like celebrities. That's just the world that in which we live. But there is one of the most famous Torah scholars in the world today, Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, who lives in Bnei Brak and does nothing but learn all day, quite literally. He's been doing it for like the last 70 years. He never really like accepted the mantle of leadership, but it was kind of foisted on him to varying degrees. And he just sits in his house all day and just learns. Just to give you an idea of how much he learns, he finishes the entire Torah. I mean, the Torah itself, the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, Medrash, Halacha, everything. He has a set amount he does every day. And every year he finishes the entirety of the Torah cover to cover. And every year on Erev Pesach, he makes a Siyum because the firstborn, speaking of firstborns, need a Siyum so they don't have to fast. And he makes a Siyum every year. And everyone makes a big deal about the grape juice that he makes the Siyum on. And that's blessed grape juice. And they send it around for all sorts of stuff. And when it's a leap year, he's got an extra month this year. So what does he do with the extra month? There's one extra month this year. We have an extra month this year. We have two Adars. Yeah, two Adars. What does he do? So on a leap year, he writes a Sefer also. And he's written quite a few songs. So that is just to give you an idea of what I get. Oh, blessings. Yes. But over here, clearly these blessings are not just like, may God bless you, my son, and you have a great life. Clearly there's a lot more going on here with these blessings that, you know, Yaakov is willing to, put his neck on the line to get them. And Esau is willing to kill for Yaakov's, you know, taking them. So clearly there's a lot more going on here. So let's try to understand what's happening over here. And let's go back a little bit for a few minutes and talk about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they crash the whole world in doing so. Okay, now what happens is, as we discussed in the past, what they did was they mixed together good and evil. Whereas previously, evil was clearly evil, and good was clearly good. Now, evil and good are mixed together, which is why in the world today, everyone's fighting about what's good and what's bad, because everything is all farmished, as they say in French. Everything is mixed together. There is nothing good that doesn't have some bad mixed into it. Okay, that's why getting up on time for, let's say, davening is hard. That's why you say, I don't want to get up on time for davening, but it's the greatest thing in the world to do. But it doesn't feel like that. There's some negativity mixed in, makes it hard to get up. When you're ready to go on the ski trip, then you get up bright and early because then, you know, the Yetzer Hara is happy to let you get up and go on the ski trip. But to go study or to go help someone, that's a whole different story. And everything bad has some good mixed into it, which is why things that are bad can look tempting. And that's why you'll have so many people fighting over things. It's good. It's bad. It's terrible. It's the greatest thing in the world. No, it's the worst thing in the world. I'm not just talking about music and movies here. I'm talking about, you know, moral dilemmas and so on. Everything is mixed together.
Kale.
Huh? Everything is mixed together.
You're talking about kale.
I'm not talking about kale. Kale Melech Nemon? No. Okay. So what? The vegetable. Yes. There are bugs in it. That's the bad that's mixed in there. You have to watch out for the bugs. So everything is mixed together. The job now falls upon Adam and Eve and their descendants to sort everything out. That is to determine what is good and what is bad, to avoid the bad and push it aside, and to embrace the good. Okay? And we talked about this idea in past weeks that God was waiting for someone to step up and undertake this mission. And he's waiting and waiting and waiting and no one's doing it. Okay, Cain and Abel were the first candidates. Rashi makes the point that, the Torah makes the point, but Rashi a little bit more makes the point that Cain worked the earth, which was cursed. Okay, and the idea is that Cain is going to be the one to engage the world and try to separate the good from the bad. It didn't work out so well. Okay, instead he got sucked in by the evil. What?
Why is the earth cursed?
The earth is cursed because the earth is the source of physicality. As opposed to the physical side of man, which now became much more dominant, is the source of the earth. That's what the Torah says, that God cursed the earth from which Adam was taken. Right? What did the earth do wrong? Nothing. The point is that what?
Cursed because of the blood.
That was later. That was after Cain killed Hevel. But first, the earth was cursed because Adam and Eve ate from the tree. Later on, it was cursed further. The idea is that we look at the physical world as earth. person comes from earth. The idea is that the physical side of the person comes from the earth. That's the physical animalistic side. Okay. The sensuous, lustful, desirous, egotistical side of the person. Correct. But it's also, it's Adam Adama, but others point out it's also Aleph, as in godly, and Dam, which is blood. You have the two putting together. But yes, Adam is from the cognate of the word Adama. He comes from the earth. And so Cain engages the earth, but at the same time, he's supposed to be engaged in this spiritual effort to engage this mixture of cursedness and to sort everything out. Alas, instead, he gets sucked into it, ends up killing Hevel, and things don't end well over there. Hevel goes and takes care of sheep, and the commentators point out that you will notice that many great people were shepherds. The patriarchs were Abraham and Jacob and Yaakov were shepherds. Moshe is a shepherd. David is a shepherd. Why are they all into sheep? It's not because they like lamb chops, okay, or feta cheese. It's because, not that there's anything wrong with feta cheese, I think it's great, but it's because when you're a shepherd, it gives you plenty of time to sit around and meditate, right? Because you ever see what do shepherds do? They just sit around and they play flutes and watch the sheep. They're not doing, it's not a distracting line of work. Okay, and the commentators say that the reason why you find so many great people who were shepherds were that it enabled them to meditate on the greatness of God. But the other side is that the shepherd is not getting in his hands dirty. He's not getting into the dirt. He's not digging. He's not engaging the physical side of the world. He's kind of just, kind of meditating all the time. And so you have this relationship between what was supposed to happen. Cain and Hevel was, Cain is one who's going to engage the physical world and tackle it and engage it and overcome it, sort things out. And Hevel is going to be the one who's meditating, who is going to then connect that sorted out world back to its spiritual source. That was supposed to be the partnership. It didn't work out that great, because what tends to happen when you have people operating on opposite poles, when they can't come together, they are at loggerheads. Okay. And so the next candidates for this role are Yaakov and Esav. Esav is born. He's clearly a very physical being. He's already born, so to speak, ready-made, as his name indicates, with physical maturity and so on. The idea is that the stress of Esav is on the physical side of himself. Okay? He's a hunter. He's out in the fields and so on. He's out in the world. What does Yaakov do? He's sitting in the basement all day studying. He's a Yoshev Olam. He sits in tents. What do you think he's doing in tents? He's in tents studying. Oh, that's what he's doing. Huh?
Oh, hell.
No, it's actually heaven. That is what Yaakov's doing. And again, the partnership that's supposed to happen is Esav is indeed supposed to go out in the world and engage the physical world and conquer, so to speak, the physical world, okay, and separate the good from the evil, embrace the good and push aside the evil. And then he will kind of hand that now sorted out world to Yaakov, who will reconnect it with the original spiritual source, which was what Adam and Eve were supposed to do in the first place before they messed everything up. That's what's supposed to happen. And Yitzchak sees this is going to be the perfect partnership. Yaakov and Esav. Esav is going to be the guy on the ground doing the work, making everything happen. And Yaakov will be, in his tent, studying, praying, connecting with God all the time. Which means, if you think about it, what you essentially have over here is a Yisachar Zevulun kind of relationship. If you're familiar, the Torah tells us the tribes of Yisachar and Zevulun. Zevulun is the seafaring merchant who brings home the bacon, the sheep, the lamb, and he brings home, he makes money, and he supports Yisachar, who's sitting and studying in Kol all day. And they have this wonderful relationship. And Zevulun gets the reward equal to that of Yisachar because he is enabling and supporting that Torah study. Okay? Who's the leader? Who is the leader in the physical world? Who's running the show? Zevulun. He is the one who's actually on the ground making things happen, making the decisions, doing the hard work in terms of day-to-day operations on the ground in the world. And Yisachar is putting in the work and sweating, but over the Talmud, over the Torah in the Beis Medrash. That was supposed to be what happens with Yaakov and Esav. Not only that, we have the perfect mate for Esav, who is handpicked by God for this purpose. Her name is Leah. She's going to be the perfect partner for this to happen. And Yaakov has the perfect partner. Her name is Rachel. Okay. What happens? Same thing, similar to what happened to Cain, happens to Esav. And that is, instead of him overcoming the evil in the world, he gets sucked into it. Always a danger, right? I mean, if you want to just give an example in modern terms, you have a lot of people who go into the nitty-gritty world, let's say, of politics or the business world for that matter, to make things better, to help people until they get sucked into it. And then suddenly they find themselves on the wrong side of things until the next person comes along and says, I will make it right. Uh-huh. So, and this is, by the way, this is, you know, so this idea is as old as time itself. It's as old as time itself that people go in and they want to make a difference, and then they eventually get sucked in and they become corrupted also, because instead of pulling everyone else up, they end up getting pulled down. Not to say it's not challenging. It is challenging, very challenging. You know, don't judge anyone else until you've walked a mile in their shoes.
They'll be a mile away.
That's right. And you'll have their shoes. So, they can't come running after you.
Yeah.
What? So
usually get it out at the beginning.
My wife has been wondering the same thing also, for about 17 years. So it's, so she hasn't left yet. Anyways. So
lucky you.
Yes, indeed. Lucky me is right. So, this is what's supposed to happen. As far as Yitzchak can tell, this is moving forward. And Rashi tells us that Esav, comes to Yitzchak and seems like a very pious fellow. He says, how do you take tithes off of the straw? How do you take tithes off of salt? Stuff which really doesn't need to be tithed. He seems like a very pious fellow. Seems like he's doing everything right. Yitzchak, who is also blind, he cannot see, is kind of taken in by this whole charade of Esav. But really doesn't know that Esav has actually been corrupted to the dark side. Okay? And so Yitzchak, when it comes time to give the blessings, thinks that this partnership will be the perfect partnership. Now, if you look at the blessings, let me stop for a minute for any questions or comments. Anyone?
Oh, you're on a roll.
I'm on a roll. Okay. Anyone there? Okay. What happens now? Yeah, go ahead.
People getting sucked in to evil. I thought the whole earth is balanced. Good and evil. Balanced.
Yes.
Are they a rock in balance? Is that it?
There is a balance. Yeah, there is a balance that is struck in a general sense. But you know, where that balance manifests itself. In other words, the balance doesn't necessarily mean that it's perfectly balanced between how much good and how much evil. It's balanced in terms of the opportunities.
Oh.
Okay, for the potential. So as an example, when the sages prayed to God to abolish the drive for idolatry. Today we don't have a drive for idolatry. We have inexplicable drives for a lot of other things. Okay, but not for idolatry. So then prophecy stopped also. Why? Because the drive for idolatry is an inexplicable but spiritual drive to connect to something beyond yourself, right? And so that is balanced by prophecy. When the drive for idolatry goes, the drive, the ability to connect in a good way, that is prophecy, goes as well. Okay, so that is an idea that the potential is always there. But the world itself is not at all necessarily balanced at 50-50 good and evil. The potential, the opportunities are balanced. Okay? Yeah.
Is hunting considered bad as long as you get cut?
That is a good question. There are sources that say, because the Torah says that Esav fed Yitzchak. So they say, but you know, according to the vast majority of commentators, Yitzchak kept the Torah before it was given. He knew prophetically what was expected. Well, how is Esav hunting and feeding Yitzchak from that meat? So they said that he was such an expert hunter, he actually was able to, he would shoot an arrow that was sharpened as a slaughtering knife, and his expertise was such that he was able to actually slaughter the animal on the fly.
Okay,
that is good. That is good, yeah. Well, he was an expert archer. Okay, so he did, Esav did apparently slaughter them, at least for Yitzchak. He had them slaughtered properly. Okay. So, so let me just get back. Oh, so if you look at the blessings, that Yitzchak gives Yaakov, the blessings meant for Esav, you would think he would tell him, you should have wonderful children, have a lot of nachas. They should all grow up to be Torah scholars, and you should always want to pray, and you should always want to study Torah. There's none of that. Nothing. Not a word. That's what it says. It's all about physical stuff. May God give you of the dew of the earth, and the fat, I'm sorry, the dew of the heaven and the fat of the earth. you know, and your brother shall serve you, and your, you know, your foot will be on the neck of your enemy. It's all physical stuff. It's all conquering the physical world. What's up with that? Is that the kind of blessing that a nice Jewish parent gives the child today? You know, I mean, yes, we do wish our children and ourselves should have easy livelihood and so on and so forth. But generally, we focus on the spiritual and the physical as a means for the spiritual. And here, Esau is telling a lot of physical stuff. The answer is that Esau's role was to engage the physical world. That was his role. So Yitzchak is giving him a blessing. The idea, the deeper idea of a blessing is not just, you know, abrocha af dein kop, as they say in Yiddish, which is what old European bubbies would say when the child, the grandchild is being a big nudge or a big troublemaker. So she would say, abrocha af dein kop, which is a blessing on your head, is a way of saying, like, you know, you're being, quite a troublemaker right now.
Hak kop af en wand.
Yeah, that just means bang your head against the wall. Yeah, that's that too. Okay, so let's move on here. The deeper idea of a blessing is the idea of broadening what you already have in your arsenal. In other words, you have abilities, you have talents, you have tools. Use them in the right way. Make the most of them. Maximize your potential. That's the idea of a blessing. A curse is the idea of constriction, narrowing. And a bracha is the idea of expanding, expansion. So it's, you have these abilities, you have these tools. God should give you the ability to use them properly to maximize their potential and so on. So if Esav's role in the world is to engage the physical world, that's what he's supposed to do. Engage the physical world and overcome it, not in the sense of just conquering it physically, but in the sense of conquering it spiritually, to overcome the evil and to dominate the evil. So that's under his thumb. Well, then he needs the tools. He needs to be able to have the dew of the heaven and the fat of the earth, and he should be victorious over the enemies and so on and so forth. That is what he needs. That's the blessing he's going to get. Okay? That is the idea of the blessing. So that is what Esau's role was supposed to be. The problem is, Yaakov already years earlier sees this is not happening. It's not happening. Yaakov sees that this partnership that's supposed to happen between him and Esav is not going to come to fruition. Esav is corrupt and he's corrupting his role, and Yitzchak is not catching on. And so Yaakov therefore figures out a way to get Esav's mission from him and for Yaakov himself to take it over. He buys the rights of the firstborn. And with it comes the entire mission that comes with it of that firstborn. And Rivka knows about this. And Rivka also sees that Esav is not going to carry out his mission. Some say that the reason why Rivka knew better than Yitzchak was because Rivka, when she was pregnant, Torah tells us that the children were struggling within her. And she went to a local prophet. She didn't go to her husband. She went to Shem, Noah's son. Shem, with an M at the end. And she went to Shem, and Shem, as a prophet, communicated to her what God said. God said, you have two children within you, and they're going to fight, they're going to struggle. And so Rivka knows already that this is destined to happen. There's going to be a fight and a struggle over here. There's going to be a fight and a struggle, and so Rivka already knows this prophecy. Now, she doesn't share this prophecy with her husband. Why? Because you're not allowed to share a prophecy with someone else unless you have permission to do so. And so Yitzchak doesn't know this prophecy, but Rivka knows this prophecy. And so Rivka is keeping a close eye out to see what's going to happen over here. And she sees how things are developing. There's going to be a struggle. And she understands that this struggle is going in a direction, not a struggle where they will kind of eventually balance each other out, Yaakov and Esav. But she sees this struggle is happening, that Esav is not partnering with Yaakov. And therefore, she says to Yaakov, you have no choice. You have to take over Esav's mission as well. And so now Yaakov is going to not only have to engage in his mission of being the one who studies Torah and connects to God and meditates and so on, he's going to have to take on Esav's mission of engaging and struggling with the world, which is what happens next week, right? He goes out to Lavan, and he has to now work and struggle with Lavan, who is not a great guy, and not be sucked in. Maybe we'll talk about that next week.
He was in Haran.
Huh? Lavan was in Haran, yeah. Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay? Yeah. Go ahead.
Did you get a feeling from this that she didn't love her children equally?
It's hard. It's very hard. I mean, the Torah says, the Torah, I mean, you can't get better than the Torah. The Torah says Yitzchak loved Esav and Rivka loved Yaakov. Now, it's important for me to note the following idea. The commentators point out, by the context of the Rachel Leah situation, and the Torah says that Yaakov loved Rachel, and it says he despised Leah. So the commentators say, how can you say on a righteous man of Yaakov's caliber that he despised Leah? Well, he despised her. I mean, he had six kids with her. He lived with her for all those years. He despised her? What does that mean? So the commentators say, this is certainly true in the context of a relationship where there are two individuals competing for the same attention, that he didn't despise Leah, but because he showed greater love and affection to Rachel, so the feeling of Leah was that my husband hates me. It wasn't that he despised her. It's that because he loved Rachel more, so therefore the perception or the way it came across was that Leah was the despised wife, even though it wasn't actual hatred. There's actually a whole discussion in the Medrash about their conversation. Actually, it says that Yaakov came to Leah and said, you tricked me. And Leah said, look who's talking. Well, how did you get those blessings exactly? And, you know, on a simple level, this is precisely the point. Just to come bring this full circle, this conversation. Leah was supposed to marry Esav. Rashi says that Leah was supposed to marry Esav, but she married Yaakov. Why? Well, because Yaakov took over Esav's mission. So the partner in that mission is Leah. She's going to have to marry Yaakov now. But that mission comes about through deceit and trickery. Okay, and let me now take this whole conversation full circle. When you engage and struggle with evil, you cannot face it head on. You will lose. That's true both within your own self. It's true in the broader world. You can't try to negotiate with evil straight up. You have to use deceit and trickery. Yaakov is called the Ishtam, the wholesome person. He never engaged in trickery in his whole life. Suddenly he's thrust into this situation by his mother. He's going to go in. He's going to trick his father. He's putting on, you know, this fake hairy skin and so on and so forth. Yaakov's like, this is not me. And Halloween's over already. So like, what is happening over here? What's going on? The answer is, but you bought this literally. Like, this is the mission you now have to go on. And when you engage evil, again, within one's own personal struggles and with the world inside and outside, you have to deal in an underhanded, deceitful fashion. Yaakov's challenge is to not get sucked into that deceit. You have to sometimes deal deceitfully, but not get sucked in and become a deceitful person. That is the challenge. It's an enormous challenge. That's a huge challenge, right? So that is Yaakov's challenge. That is Esau's challenge. That becomes Yaakov's challenge, is you have to struggle with evil, which means you have to beat evil at its own game without becoming evil yourself. That is an enormous, enormous struggle and enormous challenge, which we struggle with every day. So, you know, just going back to what I started with, you want to get up early in the morning to go to shul, to go help someone, et cetera, et cetera, just to say, I'm getting up and that's it. Well, the Shulchan Aruch does say you should rise like a lion early in the morning. But, you know, it says, "B'tachbulis asu mulchama," use devices, use tricks to wage war. If you want to win at war, you've got to be tricky. You've got to be clever. You've got to one-up your enemy. And that's true when you wage war against the Yetzer, against the evil inclination. You can't just, you know, decide, I'm going to do this, come what may. You have to engage in deceit. Very often you have to kind of throw a bone to your lower self. So for example, if you want to make sure you go to shul on Shabbos, and you say, nah, you can be lazy, you'd rather watch the football game, whatever it is. Okay? What do I do? Well, I've got a big kiddush. Oh, I like a big kiddush. Okay, I'll go. Now, if you're going only for the kiddush, that's not the goal. I want to go for the davening. But there's that incentive, that prize at the end, there'll be a kiddush. Right? So you're supposed to engage, but I'm not doing it for the sake of heaven. If you only try to do it for the sake of heaven off the bat, you're not going to get anywhere. You have to engage and throw the Yetzer a bone sometimes to keep him happy. You have to throw the Yetzer Hara a bone.
Oh, the bone
to keep him happy. Okay? Otherwise, you're going to end up with a bone of contention. So if you want to avoid that, you have to engage in deceitful tactics. And that's what's happening over here. Why did Yitzchak? So that is what's going on. That is what was supposed to happen was Esav is supposed to be a partner with Yaakov. Esav is supposed to go through the world and conquer it in the sense of spiritually. And Yaakov is supposed to then connect that now sorted out world back to its source, back to God. Esav fails. Now Yaakov has to take over. Now Esav's most famous descendant is this little nation called Rome. Okay, and Rome is the paradigm of conquering, but now in the spiritual sense. Esav's nature, his mission of conquering the world comes out in full force with Rome. And that's why the Jewish people in Rome did not get along very well for many, many, many years. And even until today, Christianity and Judaism for most of the last 2,000 years didn't exactly see eye to eye. Okay. And the center of Christianity, I'm not getting involved in Catholicism, Protestantism, and so on, is Rome until this day. In other words, the Esav Yaakov struggle continues. And how Catholicism plays into Esav is not my discussion right now. That needs a discussion unto itself. And where Yishmael and the Arabs fit in this discussion unto itself also. Not for now. But the point is that the struggle continues until today. This idea. But the upshot is that the Jewish people took over that role of struggling with the physical world. Okay, and so that's something that we do until today. We are very much engaged in the physical world. We don't encourage just meditation all the time. There are times for meditation. There are times for study. But to live your life on a mountaintop in Tibet somewhere, trying to figure out, trying to achieve spiritual nirvana is not what is encouraged. Okay, at the same time, going to nirvana concerts is not encouraged either. You've got to know, be hard now also. The balance of engaging the world and not letting you suck you in is what Judaism is all about. We engage the world, but we do it with mitzvos. We do it in a way of making it spiritual and of bringing it up. And that is really what Esav was supposed to do, but it became the Jewish people's mission. And so we kind of engage both of those poles throughout our lives. What did Yitzchak not see? Well, just to conclude with, what did Yitzchak not understand? Where did Yitzchak miss Esav in this context? So there are different approaches. I will just share one interesting approach with you, and that is the following. Yitzchak had a similar nature, or shall we say mission, in terms of his temperament to Esav, in the sense that Yitzchak spent his life conquering his own self. This idea of conquering, really the Mishnah says, in Avos, Esav hu gibor, who is strong? Hakovish is Yitzro. He who conquers his own Yetzer hara. This midah, this trait, this quality of conquering, of overpowering, can be expressed in a positive way by overpowering your own lower self. That's the positive way to express it. The negative way is to be busy overpowering everyone else.
Just do what?
Be busy overpowering everyone else, right? Every trait within the human psyche can be expressed in a positive way or a negative way. Chesed, kindness, can be done in a positive way of expanding oneself, of giving to others in a way that helps them develop. Helps them and so on. It could be in a negative way where you just flood people with too much stuff, or in the area of relationships, especially where the other side is not interested in receiving and you give it anyways. Okay. That is a negative way of expressing it. So spreading expansion, connecting to others can be done in a positive way. That's positive chesed. Give it in a negative way. Okay. Which is negative chesed. Overpowering, we call din or conquering, can be done in a positive way. Conquer yourself. Overcome your own lower self. It can be done in a negative way where you're busy overpowering everyone else. You yourself, I'm perfect. I don't need to conquer myself. I'm fine. Right? And if you ever look at it, it's not unusual for, I mentioned before, people who go into politics to make the world a better place. They will, you look at the world scene, a lot of dictators, modern day over the last 100 years, came to power because initially they came to power because they wanted to help people out. Communism is a good example, right? It was meant to help everyone. Didn't really work out so much. Why? Because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And that's what happened. So all these people who came to help everyone, and everyone's going to be equal and comrades, everyone's going to share the wealth, it's going to be a workers' paradise, it ended up being a workers', as you expressed so nicely earlier, not such paradise. The other side of it, because instead of using a nice idea called sharing in a positive way, it becomes in a very negative way. It goes off the rails. Everything can be done positive or negative. So Yitzchak is the paradigm of overcoming oneself. He is the one who's willing to sacrifice himself for God. He's the carbon. That's the ultimate in overpowering and submitting yourself before God. That's the ultimate expression. That is Yitzchak's life. Because Yitzchak lives his life in this way, Yitzchak has the commentators say that Yitzchak reached a level where he did not see any evil in the world anymore. He wasn't able to perceive it because he had completely moved it out of his life. He had so overcome his lower self that he no longer lived in a world where he could perceive the evil around him. Some say that's expressed through his blindness. His blindness is a manifestation of not being able to see the physical world anymore. He had moved past it completely. He was living in a world where he only saw the good, and the bad was completely outside of his realm. The problem was when he encountered an Esav who had so much potential for good, but also had enormous evil within him. He wasn't able to see that the evil was taking over because just how he was blinded. Who, Esav?
Yeah, because yes, he
forgave
Yaakov. He said, okay.
Okay, so that was a temporary. The commentators say that was temporary because of the spur of the moment. But if you want to know where that good was, though, his head is in the Maariv Machpelah. Esav's head ends up buried in the cave. Why? Because in his head, in his mind, all the potential was there. It never made its way down to his day-to-day existence. So his head ends up, the potential for greatness was there in his mind, right? But how it expressed itself was completely corrupted. So only his head ends up in there. Okay, so Yitzchak, then the commentators say, was not able to perceive Esav for what he was because he wasn't living in a world of being able to see evil anymore. Rivka, commentators say, grew up in an environment where she saw evil on a daily basis and had to struggle with it. So Rivka was very keenly aware of understanding and relating to evil when she encountered it. And so Rivka was able to perceive Esav for what he truly was. And so Rivka made that decision. Other sources say the question is, even if Yitzchak couldn't see on his own, why didn't God tell him? So there's a lot of discussion that Yaakov had to go through this process because in engaging and struggling with evil is the process of struggling and being clever and being somewhat deceitful in that sense. And therefore, God did not tell Yitzchak what was really going on because Hashem wanted Yaakov to engage in that process. He had to go through that process in order to ultimately be victorious. So, like I said, the bottom line for us is we go through these struggles all the time in our lives that we have to engage with less positive things, both within ourselves and in the world around us. To try to struggle with it head on is very, very difficult and nigh well impossible. The way to overcome it is not necessarily to lie outright, but to be clever and to engage it in a way that you can kind of come around from the back and be successful in that way instead of trying to engage it head on. Okay, so that's my piece for today. If there are any final questions or comments, I'm happy to take them.
Seems like Rivka was basically the powerhouse.
Rivka was the powerhouse. In this case, Rivka was the one who understood what had to happen.
Because Yaakov really didn't want to put the fur on.
Right.
He wanted to see his father. And,
correct. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Right. She had to. And not only that, you know, Yaakov was nervous. He says, if my father catches me, he's going to curse me. So Rivka tells him, Alai kil lascha b'ni, your curse is on my head. So she was putting her neck on the line also. You know, if Yaakov gets caught, that curse is going to devolve onto her head as well. So she was taking a big risk over here. It wasn't just, you know, like telling her kid, go west, young man, and, you know, and good luck. She was putting her neck on the line here also.
So I heard she got cursed a little bit because she wasn't able to see her son for 22 years.
That I don't know. It's possible. Like okay. Yaakov, okay, that's another discussion. Yaakov would pay the price later for not honoring his parents for all those years. And he was paid in kind by not having Yosef around for all those years. Again, that's a whole discussion unto itself. What did he do wrong? He had to leave. So that's not for now. Okay.